So you get the idea. For a long time, there was danger everywhere. We had a limited life expectancy, and the brain was very much set up to alert us for dangers, for fight or flight threat situations where we'd have to immediately jump into action to save our lives. Now, today, the average adult will have very, very few, will encounter very few situations where we'll have to fight or flee for our lives. I can't, as an adult, remember having to fight for my life. I can't recall really having to run for my life. It's certainly not since I got sober. Before then was a blur, and that's another story. But perhaps, maybe, at most, when we're driving or riding our bikes in the city, we might encounter a few threats. But by and large, the human brain is on a hair trigger that is completely unnecessary. And so where do we expend these unnecessary responses? Well, largely on the little inconveniences in life, the things we don't like other people doing, the little remarks that people say, the times we miss the, you know, subway, the times that we're running late or somebody else is not living up to expectations. We have the exact same neural response that we did when a wild boar was bearing down upon us, or a wild elephant, and we were in mortal danger. In fact, actually, when they look at the kind of neural responses we have, the hormonal and neural responses we have, even during slightly unpleasant images we're exposed to, it's still that same threat, fear, survival response. So you might ask, well, okay, so we're overreactive, but what's the big idea about it? Well, health-wise, it's extremely bad for us. That's just a starter. When we are constantly triggering the amygdala, we're releasing cortisol, which actually plays a very damaging role in the human body. It's meant for us to survive immediately. It doesn't actually have a lot of good results in the long term. It leads to arterial sclerosis, hardening of the arteries. It leads to the underproduction of white blood cells, T cells, and the overproduction of red blood cells. So it leaves us very much at risk for diseases, and even worse, it leads to cell death, which leads to premature aging. There's a lot of good science that shows that people who are more stressed out tend to age quicker. And then on top of it, it has enormous psychological damages for the long term. Leads to insomnia. It leads to certainly overreactivity. It leads to, a lot of studies show, in terms of the damaging effects it has on relationships, especially as we head into our older years. The more stress we're under, the less we can successfully navigate through interpersonal, compromising and stuff like that, because we're constantly in a defensive posture. So we are, there's also a lot of correlation with heart disease, of course, and I could go on. Also insomnia. So stress is not a good thing. I hope this is not news to anybody, but got to go over it just in case there's one of you who came in. I thought stress was good. So the Buddha said that when we encounter inconveniences and bad news, things we don't like, we react with what's called dukkha, which is his word for stress and suffering. And he said that when we encounter dukkha, it plays out in two ways. This is in his teaching in the Shorter Discourses. He says the first way is generally we get confused as to what's causing it, and then we run to the quickest way out, the fastest way out, and we try to survive at all costs, regardless of what the long-term outcomes are. So this confusion when we look at it deeper in the Buddhist teachings is basically that there is, of course, two components to all suffering. There's the first arrow, which is the shit that happens to us in the world. You know, the slight insult, the missing of the train, the stubbing our toe, the, you know, getting put on hold when we're trying to call an operator or something like that. There's the actual event, which is then filtered into the mind, which we then react to. And the Buddha said this reaction, the second and third and fourth arrows we shoot in or to ourselves, is our role in it. And our role often far, far outweighs the original first arrow. For instance, if somebody cuts us off when we're, I don't know, I fucking never drive, but, you know, you're trying to merge, I guess, and somebody cuts you off and then says, hey, watch what you're doing, even though you feel you're in the right. And then as we drive along, we might replay the story in our heads. I can't believe that guy. It was my turn. It was every other person, and this guy is yelling at me, and what right does he have, and blah, blah, blah. So what we've done is we've taken the original insulting action, we've replayed it 20 times in our mind, and then we call up somebody, guess what happened to me? And then we post on Facebook, somebody did it! And then we tweet it, you know, keep it under 148, you know, characters, and then we, you know, we let our parents know, or our friends know, and then our board, people we're in the relationship with, while they're eating dinner, and, you know, we're telling them about the guy who cut us off. So we've replayed, we've shot ourselves with 20 or 30 more arrows. So, there's a saying that, that stress, the amount of stress we have, is directly correlated to how reactive we are. Not to the amount of bad events that happen to us, but how we are reactive. That's also important because, as the Buddha teaches in the First Noble Truth, in our lives there will be certain kinds of dukkha that are absolutely necessary, that will happen. We have no choice about them. This is the first type of dukkha, and it's the dukkha of simply what you get for signing up for human birth. Namely, we will all grow old, we will all get sick at times. Beyond death, there's also additionally going to be, he then goes on to say, there will be times when we don't get what we want. There will be times when we wind up with people we don't like. There'll be times when inconvenient things will happen. In one sutta, he goes on to this list of saying things like mosquito bites, you know, and sitting in poor chairs is another example he gives. So, you know, this primary dukkha that we cannot avoid will happen, and yet our minds react to it as if we can somehow, if we just figured it all out, and just had the proper way to get rid of it all, that we could never, ever encounter any discomfort in our lives. That's the cause, the root ignorance, the avijja, as the Buddha called it, that leads to lasting, continual human suffering. It's not the little bumps and bruises, the sharp elbows, the things that we wish other people didn't say or do. It's the way we react to life. We react to life like there's something wrong when things don't go our way, when we're inconvenienced. It was funny, as I was saying last night, I was going on vacation to Costa Rica, first vacation in a long time, and naturally, as intelligent people do, I went to the wrong airport, which left just enough time to get from JFK to LaGuardia, and because I assumed that all you know, international flights went from JFK, but I didn't take into account that the first part of the flight was down to Miami, which is actually, although I like to think of Miami as another country, it's actually in the same country, so it is still considered to be a domestic flight, those fuckers. So, I don't know why I'm making the plane gesture. I haven't even gotten on the plane in the story. So that's just turning the page in this story. Basically, as I'm riding in the taxi from JFK to LaGuardia, part of my mind, literally, while there was the, you know, I was relaxing myself from the parts of the stress response, another part of my mind was saying, God damn it, this city has to have two fucking airports. Never mind. Anyway, this is an example of just how even when we're completely at owning the stress, the cause of the stress, even when we're completely to blame, we try to make it about the world. We don't acknowledge our role. We're constantly saying, oh, if only I could get rid of this one person at work, then my job would be great. If only I could get rid of that roommate, I'd love my living condition. If only I could, you know, get rid of this one thing I have to do, then we could. When I get through with my taxes, the rest of the, when I, you know, and of course, whenever those things actually do magically disappear, life isn't suddenly rosy and endlessly filled with completely stress-filled days. We find another inconvenience and another inconvenience and another inconvenience. And yet we still blame the world for our suffering rather than looking at the bulk of those arrows which are being shot into us by ourselves. So how do we shoot those five arrows into ourselves? Well, the Buddha, there's five domains, the Buddha says, we can expect to find them. The first is in the breathing. When we breathe shallowly and incompletely, we're unconsciously triggering ourselves to say that we're going to have to flee or fight or do something, you know, for our survival. And very often, when I'm on the computer, just on, you know, looking at, you know, I don't know, some stupid site, whatever I'm doing, you know, I notice, and like the brain is like, like, you know, like, you know, like somebody's about to throw a spear at me, or, you know, like, you know, I'm completely wrapped, the face is 4 inches away, I'm trying to get into the screen, breathing like this, you know, that's a way to trigger the entire stress response. Already the amygdala is firing, the insula is reporting danger, danger, the orbital frontal is waking up and the brain going, what the fuck's going on? And the brain's like a wire of like, you know, alert, 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 and, you know, cortisol is being released and hormones that get ready for action and nothing the fuck is going on. I'm just looking at my computer. On the other hand, when we breathe deeply and we trigger the vagus nerve in the abdomen, that is a nerve that actually triggers what's known as the parasympathetic nervous system, which releases serotonin. So that actually does the exact opposite. It tells us, basically, calm down. It's all okay. It's all okay. Which brings me actually to another joke. I told this one last night, but it's actually appropriate. So there's the plane with the pilot and three passengers, and Newt Gingrich, a Buddhist monk and a hippie. I make it Newt Gingrich just to waken you up, because you've all heard the plane joke. But anyway, so the plane gets, you know, motor malfunction, it starts going down, and the pilot turns and he says, well, I've got bad news and good news. The bad news is we're going down. The good news is that we've got three parachutes. Unfortunately, there are four of us, so I'm taking one, and he grabs the parachute, jumps out of the plane. So now there are two parachutes and three passengers, at which point Newt Gingrich turns to the other two, and he says, well, not only am I the richest, but I'm the smartest person on this plane, so I'm taking the next, and he grabs it and jumps out of the plane. So the Buddhist monk turns to the hippie, and he says, Well, I've lived a long life. I've been preparing for death for many years, so you can have the last parachute. At which point, the hippie says, chill out, man. The smartest guy on the plane just leapt out with my backpack. That's a... That would be an example of the stress response that we have. And the hippie would be the chill response, which is it's going to be okay, just breathe deeply. When we can see the way we're breathing and can just deepen the breath and relax it, make the breath full enough so that we can actually feel the movement of the torso, what we're doing is we're triggering part of the brain that says it's all going to be okay. Now, it takes a little while for the stress hormones to leave. There's as much as 15 to 20 minutes when people are having panic attacks before the cortisol will dissipate. So it might take a little while, but it does start the process of relieving the physical stress. The second is we have a physical aversion to discomfort and inconvenience. It's literally a tightening. In my case, as I was saying the other day, it was very much a tightening in my stomach. It was the anniversary of a friend's death, and I remembered it, and I became very sad. And a part of me didn't want to be sad, didn't want to have that day be the anniversary, didn't want to be in a place of going through the feelings again. And so I had the feeling of the sadness in my throat. It was sort of this sort of vaguely nauseous feeling. But then there was this reaction to the sadness, which was, go away. I don't want to feel this way. And that was in my stomach. It was like this tightening, this feeling of, you know, why do I have to feel this way right now? And so while at no point does the Buddha ever teach not feeling our feelings. In fact, that's very much a core part of the practice, is awareness of Vedana. The Buddha does say, though, to notice which parts of our bodies always react to inconveniences and get tight. Very often it could be my shoulders when I'm inconvenienced, or my stomach when I'm upset about something, or it could even be my jaw locking. Everybody reacts in their own different ways. So as time goes on and you become more mindful, especially in meditation, it's an opportunity to see and notice how inconveniences physically play out in the body. And when we find these stresses, what we then can do is, of course, relax them. We can relax them by simply saying, let go. You know, I invite you to release. We can breathe into the area. Imagine, see how the breath, the relaxed breath goes through it. We can just consciously see if we can feel the energy moving up and down through it. There's lots of different ways to ease the body. But almost always when we note that there's a tightness, we do have some ability to release tension just by noticing it. The key is noticing it. Most of the time we're unaware of the tightness that we're carrying around, the stress that we're carrying around. It's like when we go up to the country after we've had a couple of busy, you know, weeks, and then we finally get away, and then you might notice after a few days your shoulders are relaxing, and you didn't even notice that your shoulders were tight all the time. Or we go to maybe to somebody who gives massages, and they say, my God, your shoulders are completely locked. And we're not aware of it because we live our lives so externally and so unaware of what's going on internally. The third way we add reactivity is what the Buddha called perceptions, or sanna, which is basically the brain locks in on the event, and it basically adds a headline. The headline is sort of like, this is wrong. Something fucked up is happening. Holy shit. Or, I've got to keep alert to this. I've got to keep focused to it. It's this underpinning of the mind, this hyper-focus on the perception that locks in. Have you ever been at a party when an ex comes in? You know, and you really on an intentional level may not want to have a fucking idea who they're with or what they're doing, but the brain doesn't participate.
The brain's like, meet, 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 meet. They are now 3 meters over there at an angle of 25 degrees, and people are talking to you.
You know, there's hundreds of other people you can focus on. But the one person you don't want to be focusing on, the brain, not literally making that sound. I'm just adding that for humor and entertainment purposes. So that's a no added fee, by the way. We literally react to things as if there's something wrong going on. As monk Ajahn Brahm often says, he says, when we get sick or we stub our toe or somebody does something inconvenient, rather than say there's something wrong, we should say there's something right happening, because this is what life is. Being inconvenient, stubbing your toe, you know, getting sick, this is what life contains. There's nothing wrong about it. But we react as if when the subway door closes in our face as we run into the subway, why is the world doing this to me? Why? Why me? They somehow knew it was me and they closed the doors on me. It's fucked up. So, the fourth way is not just with perceptions, but with sense consciousness. We tend to focus our awareness on the senses that are aware of the inconvenience. And we become unaware of all the other senses where nothing is going on. For example, if we smell a bad aroma, we get into a subway car, and maybe somebody who had some issues was in there, and there's this horrible aroma. Dharma punks, I can talk about whatever the fuck I want. Get with it. So there's this aroma. Work with me, kids. So, and you don't know where it is, what it's emanating from, and you probably really wouldn't want to know, even if you did. So, but can you turn off the sense of smell? No, you can't. Maybe you can, but most of us, well, the nose is suddenly, I haven't been participating at all in the last 23 hours, but now I'm going to tell you everything about this aroma for the next 15 minutes. I'm going to give you every nuance in it, every overtone in the perfume of life that we're now smelling. And so rather than, as the Buddha teaches in the five ways of dealing with obsession, he says, focus away. The mind tends to go to the sense port that's bringing all the bad news. It can be sound when we're in meditation, and there could be a sound that somebody's doing. It will happen. Somebody will be clucking their tongue for whatever reason they need to. I've actually was at a retreat once when somebody was clucking their tongue for at least a half an hour. How that helped, I don't know. But my mind went there for a while. You know, and I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't, you know, even go to metta meditation. I was just, the mind was dragging me to the inconvenient sound. So part of it is the way we react to the sense port. And then the fifth is, of course, thinking. The role that the thought-based sankharas play in our fifth aggregate is thinking. And this is basically falls into the rubric of we have in generally three, the Buddha says, or at least three, maybe four misperceptions of the world that make our reactions even worse. We expect things in the world to be consistent and to last. And we get upset when things fall apart, when they break, when they stop working. We expect things to give lasting, consistent pleasure, and we become upset when we get bored or they no longer give the joy that they once did. We expect things to be controllable and ownable and ours, and in fact, our bodies age without our permission. The things we own get taken without our permission or separated from us. As the Buddha says, everything we love will be eventually separated from us. It's just the nature of life. So we have these reactions. We think things will be permanent. We think that they'll be consistent in their pleasure and that they'll be ownable and controllable, and they don't fall under any of those categories. If we expected the things to be impermanent, for pleasure to not last forever, and for all things to have downsides to them, if we expected, you know, along with sunny days, for there to be gray skies and for good remarks and for approval we get, if we also expected there to be disapproval and times when people didn't do the things we wanted. So, but we're always going at life as if it should always be pleasant, and there shouldn't be any discomfort, and there shouldn't be any inconveniences. And each time it comes up, we get reactive to it. We try to push it away. We try to figure it out. We try to add all this thought and obsessive, oh, what can I do to make this work? You know, why is this happening to me? Especially that seeing things, taking them personally. That's probably the fourth way we add suffering. Every experience, when somebody says something we don't like, when we experience an inconvenience, we add a why me, why always me to it. When in fact, all of the inconveniences and the slights and the things that comprise dukkha that occur in life happen universally. They happen to everyone. Nobody gets away. Nobody gets away without heartache. Nobody gets away without disappointment. Nobody goes through this life without, you know, being separated from what they love and not being with people that they want to be and being with people that they don't like. It's a universal experience. And yet, as we leave our meditation and we go out into life, again, we might run into somebody that we don't want to speak, and the first reaction will always be, I guarantee you. So the first reaction might be this, oh no, get away, fight or flight, leave me alone. But we can override it. We can override on those five different areas. We can watch, be vigilant, and reduce the amount of reactivity. So we're much more calm, so we're much healthier in the long term, so we're much more psychologically healthier in the long term, so we're much happier in the long term by reducing the amount of unnecessary reactivity we bring to our lives. How do we do that? In meditation, this meditation we're going to do, when we experience some inconvenience, it could be the sound somebody's making, it could be a car horn that's going to be coming, no doubt, the moment we start, or a buzzer ringing on the front door, or it could be an unpleasant memory will arise. It could be, and feel free to, by the way, bring up consciously an unpleasant memory. Not the most traumatic thing that happened in your life. We're not going to do that. We're going to think of something unpleasant and inconvenience that happened recently. So as this arises, whether it's a real-time event or something that happened recently, we'll first scan the breath, and we'll relax the breath, and we'll make the breath as deep as we can, so we start to relax around the experience. We're not adding to the car horn, the unpleasant memory. We're not adding more stress by breathing shallowly. We're going to keep the breath relaxed. And then what we're going to do is we're going to scan the body so that as we have this unpleasant experience, we're then going to release any tension that arises as a reaction to it. And then, as we have this unpleasant memory or the actual events going on, could be a buzzer or whatever, somebody doing something we don't like, we're then going to tell the mind, instead of allowing it to perceive it as something wrong is happening, we're simply going to name it. Car horn, buzzer, unpleasant memory, feeling tightness in my leg, pain in back, whatever. It could be a pain that's arising in the body. The interesting thing about this teaching, the Buddha said, is that the way we react to the biggest, most horrible events in life, bad news, death, disease, is the exact same way we react to the small, little, unpleasant inconveniences. The exact same way. Exact same way. So if we can train the mind to not be overreactive and to be calm, we can then, with the big events in life, not overreact and be calm. Because if we stomp our feet when we don't get what we want and we're in a fight, we're also going to stomp our feet at the mildest inconvenience in life. So this is a training that plays out across all of our experience. The fourth way we're going to work with it is when, if a sensation is unpleasant coming from the outside, if it's from hearing or if it's from smell, God forbid, but it could happen, we'll just practice scanning the body for other sensations, moving the sense awareness to other sense ports so that we can balance the mind and not overreact to the discomfort. And finally, instead of when allowing the mind to fall into the why me, why is this happening to me, I'm always the victim, you know, if our mind is jumpy during the meditation, it doesn't settle down, rather than allowing the thoughts to go to why is it I can't meditate, we're just going to change all the thoughts towards thoughts of gratitude, which is simply feeling grateful for the fact we're taking any time to practice meditation in our lives. Because any form of practice, it's shown, and it's been demonstrated over and over and over again, any form of meditation is beneficial. So just the sheer attempt at it is doing all of us wonders. The more we're focusing inwards, developing peace within, the less destructive we'll be in our relations with other people, the less we'll overreact in our lives and our relationships, the less we'll unnecessarily have stress toxins released in our body, the less we will live constantly on edge. So this is so valuable what you're doing. So every time in your meditation when you don't feel happy with the results, instead of saying, why me, why can't I do this, I should be better, I've been meditating for a while now, and yet I still find it difficult to get as peaceful as I want. Instead, we're going to bring the mind to a sense of, I'm grateful, I deserve to be happy, I deserve to be peaceful, I'm glad I'm doing this. And you'll note that these five ways will allow us to be with all of life's inconveniences without making them worse. So, when you're ready, find your comfortable seated position. So, and close your eyes. And when we close our eyes, we're inviting ourselves to drop all of the, not only the sense port, the visual port to the outside world, but we're also dropping the stories about our lives and the thoughts about anything we've just heard and the thoughts about the rest of the evening and where we're heading in life. And when the time comes to bring to mind the inconvenient memory, we'll do that consciously and intentionally. But right now, let's just let go of anything that's happened in the past and bring our awareness to the present. And let's invite the body to relax. Just invite yourself to relax, starting with the head and just scanning down, releasing any unnecessary activity in the eyes, allowing them to settle, and the facial muscles to relax, and the jaw to hang comfortably. If your mouth fidgets, see if you can find a comfortable, unforced smile or any other position that feels good. And you can continue scanning down and releasing any tightness and the or sense of contraction in the throat. And then allowing the shoulders, of course, to drop away from the ears. And it feels good allowing them to not only drop down, but to slightly pull backwards to open up your chest. Continuing down, softening the belly, the abdomen. Really softening the belly, and then continuing with releasing the buttocks and sit bones and the thighs, upper thighs. Just allow yourself to really sink into the cushion and see if it's just your balance that's keeping you upright, not any effort exerted below the waist. That's just all very solid and heavy. And your legs are like roots merged with the floor. So see if you can release any resistance or any contraction. Just allow, just say to these muscles, just release. Allow the legs to feel like they're settling down, and even the feet are releasing. All right, so bring the awareness into the upper abdomen, chest, and see if you can take a couple of deep breaths and just find the movement of the breath in the torso. The breaths might be a little bit exaggerated in the way they expand first the belly and then the chest. And the goal is to trigger that nerve so that there's this, we learn how to manually set a kind of breathing that tells the rest of the mind and the body that everything's okay right now. We're safe. And this breathing will come in handy many, many times in life when we find ourselves in a reactive, uncomfortable place with other people and we want to react. If we have this breath, it can de-trigger the stress response and set us in the direction of being calm again. So normally we stay in this place of peaceful abiding with the breath for quite a while. But for tonight's exercise, what I'd like you to do is now, while you're keeping your awareness on the breath and the body, allow, if you would, any unpleasant or inconveniencing disruptive sounds from the outside. Or if you prefer, think of something that happened recently that you found difficult, an experience that was unpleasant, inconvenient. And as you bring it to mind, while you're aware of what has occurred, see if you can keep the breath deep. Keep the body relaxed. Note any areas that start to tense. If the mind starts to go to a place that says this sound or this body pain or this memory is wrong, just name it. Name it pain in foot or sound or memory. If at any point a sound arises that's unpleasant, rather than pushing it away or hyper-focusing on it, remind yourself to keep breathing and to be aware of the other senses that are available to you. And throughout the meditation, remember to keep a sense of gratitude that you're putting your effort into a practice that brings so many rewards, both to you and to the rest of the people in our lives. So as we enter silence now, just keep working with whatever material that's available, using your meditation as a practice for being with the discomforts of life without reacting.
So as we reach the time when we start the transition from the meditation to a more externally balanced mind, remember to note that any moment of peace in a meditation came about not by acquiring or purchasing anything or getting someone's permission. You didn't have to take anything or go anywhere. It was simply by developing a compassionate, relaxed interaction with your internal experience. And the greatest, most reliable sources of happiness are available to us unconditionally within. There's always a source of peace available to us. It's an important thing to reflect on. So very slowly make the transition to a mind that's balanced between the outside and the inside. So you don't only have to practice ways to become calm in meditation. The only opportunity is not only in meditation, but it's also in day-to-day life. Often when I'm interacting with someone and I feel a sense of unskillfulness has crept in, I'll take a moment to just have a couple of deep breaths, make sure my belly is soft, my shoulders are relaxed, and I'll tell myself, this happens to everyone. It's not about me. And if somebody's being an asshole, I'll just say, they're probably an asshole to everybody else. It's not about me. Just those three little steps can make me so much less reactive in my day-to-day life. Okay, so...